Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we cut through the noise and give you a comprehensive, granular report on the most critical actions happening right now inside the machinery of the federal government.
And then today, we are embarking on a massive deep dive into the news of really the last 48 hours. This is the Federal News Update for Tuesday, November 11th, 2025.
I'm Alex Johnson, your guide through this deluge of information, ready to unpack the policy, the politics, and that persistent regulatory machine.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, here to provide the expert analysis, connect those critical dots, and hopefully make sense of this pretty dense material for you.
Our mission today is, well, it's straightforward. We're giving you a thorough, comprehensive, and honestly exhaustive report on the actions and activities of the U.S. federal government just since the beginning of November 10th, 2025.
And we're focusing relentlessly on the immediate impact and, maybe more importantly, the long-term implications that these decisions have for you, the listener, whether they're, you know, highly visible political maneuvers or these hyper-technical regulatory changes.
You know, what really stands out about the last 2 days, it's this dramatic dichotomy. It's almost comical, the difference in the speed of government.
Right. On one side, you had this huge political event, the frantic maneuvering on Capitol Hill to finally end that 41-day government shutdown. It consumed every headline, every press conference.
Absolutely. All the oxygen in the room. The political show was just running at full volume.
But then, juxtaposed against that high-stakes drama, you have the bureaucratic regulatory machinery that, well, it never really stopped grinding.
Yeah, we've got dozens of massive, detailed regulatory actions pouring out of places like the EPA, HUD, the Social Security Administration, BOM.
And these impact everything, right? Air quality standards, trade tariffs, the very safety of our air travel system. It's a lot.
It's those two speeds of government working at the same time. You've got the political melodrama grabbing the attention.
And the technical reality that actually governs daily life.
Right.
We've really got to cover both with equal rigor today.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with that political seismic event on Capitol Hill, the end of the shutdown.
Right. Let's look at the mechanism that finally stopped the bleeding, so to speak, and reopened the government. Yesterday, Monday, November 10th, the Senate cleared that key procedural hurdle, the big one.
The one needed to advance the government funding bill.
Exactly. Signaling the definitive end of this, historically long 41-day shutdown.
And the vote tally was tight 60-40, exactly what they needed to overcome that procedural barrier and move the bill forward.
But the coalition that got them there, Alex, that's where it gets fascinating. And the political calculations behind it.
Yeah, tell us about that.
It was secured by 52 Republicans, okay, but also 8 members of the Democratic Conference, plus independent Angus King of Maine.
8 Democrats breaking ranks. That's nearly a fifth of the conference.
Right. That takes significant political capital. It suggests those 8 Democratic conference members, and we're talking high-profile names like Senators Tim Kaine, Gene Shaheen, they also secured some crucial concessions.
So what did they get? What was vital enough to make them break ranks on this?
Well, what they secured was vital for their constituents, primarily. Guaranteed back pay and jobs back for thousands of federal workers. And we even have some granular detail on this.
Oh,
yeah. It specifically guaranteed the return of 950 employees just from the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, alone. That's a concrete number.
Okay, so the political question then becomes, why did this handful of Democrats feel compelled to fold their hand, especially on what was, you know, universally recognized as the Democrats' central non-negotiable demand?
Look, the pressure was immense, and it was really twofold. First, yes, recent local election results suggested maybe Democrats weren't shouldering all the blame for the shutdown.
Okay.
But the tangible pain caused by the service gaps, that was escalating fast, beyond political tolerance. We're talking massive delays in food stamps, serious travel disruption because of FAA staffing, which we absolutely have to get into later.
Right.
And just the imminent financial ruin threatening hundreds of thousands of federal workers and contractors.
Yeah.
The pressure was just building and building.
So pragmatism basically won out over principle in this case.
Essentially, yes. As one insider analyst put it, the thinking likely became something like, look, we're simply not going to get the ACA subsidies secured in this funding bill. So let's salvage what we can, stop the economic pain for our constituents and federal workers now, rather than hold out for a political win that might just never come.
And that brings us right to the crucial omission in this deal, doesn't it? The Affordable Care Act's enhanced premium subsidies. These were the Democrats' main priority, the central sticking point that dragged this whole economic crisis out.
And they were abandoned.
Yeah.
at least in the short term. Instead of guaranteeing their extension, what happened was the Senate Majority Leader, John Thune, Republican from South Dakota, offered a kind of conditional compromise.
Which was?
He promised that Democrats would get a guaranteed vote on the ACA subsidies, but not now, by mid-December.
Wait a minute. The entire 41-day shutdown costing, what, an estimated $90 billion in economic output? It ended based on a promise of a vote, not the actual outcome.
That's right.
Historically, how much political weight does a mid-December promise from a majority leader really carry, especially when he's facing this level of fury from the other side?
Well, that's exactly the point driving the liberal fury right now. It's a massive political gamble. Critics immediately jumped on this, branding the promise the classic Lucy holding the football scenario.
Right. A setup for inevitable disappointment.
Precisely. House Representative Melanie Stansberry, Democrat from New Mexico, she was one of the loudest voices, declared a definitive hell no vote on the bill, called it terrible for, in her words, abandoning Americans' health care.
And her argument makes sense, right? Republicans can promise a vote, sure, but that doesn't guarantee a single Democratic victory. Oh. The subsidy extension needs bipartisan support. If the fight was lost now, why would it suddenly be won in December?
Exactly her point. And then you even have Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, demanding accountability at the highest level. Oh. He explicitly called for Leader Schumer's replacement. Yeah, his quote was pretty damning. If you can't lead the fight to stop healthcare premiums from skyrocketing for Americans, what will you fight for? That just shows you the profound, visible fracture within the Democratic leadership right now.
And is Schumer getting any backup?
He is, some, notably from House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, who said Schumer waged a valiant fight. But even those Democrats who broke ranks, like Senator Jeanne Shaheen, they're trying to redirect the criticism.
How so?
She argued that critics need to train their fire on President Trump and Speaker Johnson, saying, look, they were the adversaries who created this shutdown crisis, not the senators who took the necessary steps to end the suffering of federal workers. It's a bit of political deflection.
Okay, shifting over to the House side then. Speaker Johnson, he's in a pretty unenviable position here.
Absolutely. He had to call the House back into session after they'd effectively done, well, no business at all, as the report said, since September 19th.
So the House has been basically dormant for this whole closure, and now they're forced back into D.C., facing political backlash from both sides and the reality of this deepening travel crisis.
And before they could even get to the main event, voting on the funding bill itself, they hit that classic Washington speed bump. A highly specific procedural wrinkle in the Senate, courtesy of Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky.
Yes, the Rand Paul hemp hold. Always something, isn't it? An immediate legislative complication.
Exactly. Senator Paul objected to a specific provision buried deep in the agriculture part of the funding package.
What was it about?
This provision, he argued, unfairly targets Kentucky's growing hemp industry. Specifically, it restricts the sale of popular products like Delta 8-THC, which, you know, falls into kind of a regulatory gray area.
So Paul argued it was an unrelated rider and just held up the entire process.
He did. So to bypass his objection and break the logjam, what did Senate leadership have to do?
What?
They had to promise Senator Paul a standalone amendment vote on that specific hemp provision sometime soon.
It just demonstrates, doesn't it? Even when the entire federal government is hanging in the balance, a single senator can leverage the Senate's, let's be honest, arcane procedural rules to demand concessions on something as specific as Delta 8 sales in his home state.
The procedural wrangling required to move any major bill forward is often way more complex than the actual legislative substance itself. It's fascinating, in a way.
So, bottom line, the shutdown is ending. But the political cost is massive, the Democratic Party is clearly convulsing, and the big fight over ACA subsidies, it's just kicked down the road to mid-December.
Deferred, exactly. Mm-hmm. And the lasting legacy remains that estimated $90 billion economic cost of the 41-day shutdown, plus the systemic damage to the federal workforce, which, as we'll see, is really playing out in critical agencies like the FAA.
Okay, so we've covered the political headache, but the White House wasn't just sitting idle while Congress fought over back pay. The president was making a, well, a truly surprising diplomatic move on the global stage.
Yes, which leads us nicely into our next section, foreign policy, trade, and this tariff rebate turbulence.
Right. What happened?
On Monday, November 10th, President Trump held a closed-door meeting at the White House with the interim Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa.
Now, you really need to grasp the historical context here. This is the first White House visit by any Syrian leader ever.
It's a genuinely unprecedented moment in U.S. diplomatic history, no question.
And the secrecy is unusual too, isn't it? The meeting kept strictly closed door. That feels like a contrast to the president's usual style, highly publicized Oval Office photo ops with foreign leaders.
That secrecy was likely driven by the, let's say, sensitive context.
Which is?
The context is absolutely critical here. Just last week, Al-Sharia had been removed from the specially designated global terrorist list. That signals a massive pivot in U.S. recognition and engagement with the Syrian government. A huge shift.
And the president was, well, extremely complimentary afterward.
He was. Called Al-Sharia a very strong leader and a tough guy. Trump framed the visit as a success, fitting his vision for regional stability. He said, I liked him, I get along with him, the new president of Syria, and we will do everything we can to make Syria successful because that is part of the Middle East. We have peace now in the Middle East, first time anyone can ever remember that.
So he's positioning this as a key step toward peace now in the Middle East.
That's the framing.
But this immediate focus on a controversial foreign leader, it generated pretty quick domestic criticism, didn't it? Particularly from the president's own political base.
That's correct. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, publicly challenged the president's priorities. She argued he should be focusing on domestic policy, specifically healthcare reform, instead of meeting with foreign leaders.
What did she want?
She wanted, quote, nonstop meetings at the White House focused on formulating the Republican plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act.
And the president's response to Greene was pointed and public?
Very. Trump expressed surprise at her statements, suggested she has lost her way, and stated her comments show she doesn't know what she's talking about regarding the duties of the presidency.
He defended his schedule.
Yeah, noting that he averages meeting roughly one foreign leader per week, calling it a standard part of his job. This little public spat, though, it highlights a deep division, even among the president's staunchest allies, about the administration's priorities, foreign policy versus domestic legislative goals.
Okay, moving from Syria to the economic relationship with China, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, USTR, announced a pretty significant trade policy pivot tied to that recent historic trade and economic deal with Beijing.
This is a major development in global trade, make no mistake. The USTR is proposing to suspend Section 301 tariffs on China's maritime, logistics, and shipbuilding sectors for 1 year.
Starting immediately.
Starting November 10th, 2025, yes. This looked like the first concrete economic concession coming out of that new deal negotiated with President Xi Jinping.
And linked directly to the revenue generated by those tariffs is the president's, let's call it, populist economic proposal, the idea of sending tariff rebate checks to Americans.
Yes. President Trump has been openly discussing a plan to send at least $2,000 tariff rebate checks to every American below a certain income level. He's repeatedly pitched this.
And his claim is that the tariff revenue will not only fund the checks, but also help lower our debt with money left over.
That's the claim.
Okay. This is where we really need to pause. Because the economic reality, at least as analyzed by independent groups, seems to clash sharply, fundamentally, with that political pitch.
It creates a massive fiscal contradiction. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, CRFB, they're a nonpartisan fiscal watchdog group. They released an analysis on Monday tackling this claim head on.
And what did they find?
The CRB analysis states pretty plainly that rebate checks of the size and scope the president is suggesting could cost twice as much as the revenue actually generated by the tariffs.
Wait, hang on. Twice as much. So the populist pitch is the tariffs pay for themselves and reduce the debt. But the independent analysis suggests the proposed checks could significantly increase the federal deficit.
That's exactly right. It's not just a miscalculation. It looks like a fundamental deficit spending initiative being masked as some kind of dividend payout.
So what was the CRFB's point then?
Their whole point was, if the administration truly wanted to use the revenue responsibly, as they've claimed before, they should stick to that original plan, use it to reduce existing deficits, not launch a new massive cash dividend program that isn't even fully covered by the revenue stream it's supposedly based on.
And this entire populist proposal, it runs headlong into major legal stakes currently before the Supreme Court, which creates an even deeper conflict.
This is the critical contradiction, yes, and it really exposes the tight legal spot the administration finds itself in. Well, the president's ability to send those $2,000 checks, it hinges entirely on the legality and the continued collection of that tariff revenue. Yet, his administration's own legal team argued to the Supreme Court just last week that the revenue generated by the tariffs was, quote, only incidental to the trade action.
And that argument downplaying the financial impact that was necessary to legally defend the tariff authority under the specific trade laws they used, right?
Exactly. To withstand judicial scrutiny, they have to argue the tariffs are purely regulatory, not primarily revenue generating.
But by arguing the revenue is only incidental in court?
He's simultaneously pitching that very same revenue as the source for a major economic dividend, those $2,000 checks to the American public.
So if the Supreme Court rules against the administration,
it could undo the tariffs entirely. It could even require refunding billions in tariff revenue already collected. By pitching this revenue now as a guaranteed dividend source, the president is maximizing the political risk. A Supreme Court loss could not only undermine his central trade policy, but also instantly vaporize this major populist economic promise he's making.
Wow. So the political maneuver is based on a revenue stream that his own lawyers are simultaneously trying to downplay in court just to save the underlying authority itself. That is a tight, precarious spot. Billions of dollars and a cornerstone of his economic policy hanging in the balance.
It's a textbook case of conflicting priorities, isn't it? The political objective versus the legal defense.
All right, let's pivot now away from the high-stakes political conflicts and into the, well, the detailed granular machinery of the federal government, starting with a massive proposed overhaul from the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA.
Yes, this is where we get into the details that really govern the air we breathe, the chemicals we interact with every single day.
And we have two major proposed actions from the EPA, both hitting the Federal Register on Monday, November 10th. These aren't just minor technical tweaks, are they?
No, not at all. They represent pretty significant shifts in regulatory burden and environmental reporting requirements.
Okay, let's start with PFAS, perfluoroalkyl, and polyfluoroalkyl substances, those notorious forever chemicals. What's the proposal there?
The EPA is proposing to significantly loosen the reporting requirements for companies regarding their use of PFAS. Specifically, the proposed rule would exempt companies from reporting their PFAS use if the substance constitutes 0.1% or less of an item or mixture at a de minimis level.
Okay, for the listener, what does that 0.1% threshold really mean in practical terms? It sounds like a potentially major win for industry, given how widespread these chemicals are, nonstick coatings, waterproof fabric, stain resistance. They're in countless manufactured goods.
It's definitely a significant regulatory relief measure. Because PFAS are often used in very small quantities, maybe as manufacturing aids or minor components, the previous, much broader rule would have required companies to track and report potentially every single item containing even trace amounts.
Which would be incredibly burdensome.
Exactly. So this 0.1% de minimis exemption aims to filter out what the EPA is now considering trivial uses, allowing them to focus data collection efforts only on what they deem significant sources.
And what's the administration's stated rationale for rolling back these reporting requirements like this?
EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin argued that the previous rule would have imposed, in his words, crushing regulatory burdens and nearly $1 billion in implementation costs on American businesses. He particularly highlighted the impact on small businesses that just don't have the complex tracking systems that large corporations do.
So how did he frame this new proposal?
Zeldin framed it as being grounded in common sense, allowing the EPA to collect necessary data on significant sources without placing, again, his words, ridiculous requirements on every single manufacturer. The idea is prioritizing regulatory relief while still getting the key data.
Okay, moving on to the second major EPA action, the Hazardous Waste Combustors National Emission Standards for Hazardous Air Pollutants, the HWC NESHAP.
Right, this is a comprehensive proposed rule. It stems from a mandatory risk and technology review, the RTR, which is documented in, voluminous detail in the Federal Register.
And this rule specifically addresses
hazardous waste incinerators, cement kilns, and industrial boilers that burn toxic materials. Big sources.
And this review is mandated by the Clean Air Act.
Yes, the EPA has to periodically assess the residual risk to public health from these sources after the initial standards are set. And they have to determine if the current maximum achievable control technology, MAAC standards, provide what's called an ample margin of safety.
Okay, so what did the EPA's risk assessment find based on the current operational data? And maybe let's define some terms as we go for clarity.
Certainly. The EPA conducted two risk assessments. The first was based on actual emissions, what the facilities reported they were actually releasing.
And the result?
Based on these actual emissions, the maximum individual lifetime cancer risk, or MIR, is estimated to be 9 in 1 million.
Okay, break down MIR for us. What is it, and why is 9 in 1 million significant?
The MIR is the estimated lifetime cancer risk for the hypothetical person living nearest to the source facility, exposed to the highest concentration. The EPA generally uses a presumptive limit of 10 in 1 million for what's considered an acceptable risk level.
So 9 in 1 million means, based on what these facilities actually emit, they're just under that acceptable risk benchmark.
Correct. And the risk they found is primarily driven by metal compounds: nickel, hexavalent chromium, that's CRVI, and arsenic.
Okay, that's based on actual reported emissions. Now, what happens when they look at the allowable emissions, what the facilities are legally permitted to emit under their current permits? Does that change the picture?
Oh, dramatically.
Hmm.
If you look at the allowable emissions, the MIR jumps. Well, it soars, really, to 101 million.
101 million.
Yes, driven by the same metal compounds. That's 10 times greater than the EPA's usual benchmark and over 10 times higher than the risk based on actual emissions. It demonstrates a massive gap between the paper limits and the permits and the real-world performance of these facilities.
100 times greater allowable risk. That definitely raises a serious question. What about non-cancer health risks? Do they look at that?
They did. The EPA tracks non-cancer risks using something called the Total Organ System Hazard Index, or TOSHA.
Okay.
Based on actual emissions, the maximum TOSHA-I is 0.07, which is quite low. Generally, anything below 1.0 is considered acceptable, meaning adverse health effects aren't expected.
But based on allowable emissions.
Based on allowable emissions, the maximum TOSHA-I is estimated to be exactly 1 at two different facilities.
And a TOSHA-I of 1.0 means that non-cancer adverse health effects cannot be ruled out, correct?
That's right. It hits the threshold where concern begins.
What specific pollutants were driving that allowable risk hitting the threshold?
It was driven by hydrogen chloride, HCl emissions, at one lightweight aggregate kiln, and then a combination of beryllium, nickel, cobalt, and hexavalent chromium compounds at a liquid fuel boiler.
Did they estimate if actual people were exposed to that level?
The EPA noted that no people are estimated to be exposed to a TOSHA-I greater than one based on allowable emissions, but the modeling indicated that the theoretical risk does hit that 1.0 threshold.
Okay, so despite the allowable risks hitting 101 million for cancer and a TOSHA-I of 1 for non-cancer, the EPA is proposing to conclude that the current standards still provide an ample margin of safety. How do they justify that decision, especially when looking at potential technology upgrades?
This hinges on the second part of the review, the technology review. The EPA specifically considered mandating new control technologies, things like the Shell Dioxin Destruction System, SDDS, and the Gore Mercury Control System, GMCS. They evaluated whether requiring these advanced systems was necessary or, importantly, cost-effective.
And what was the finding on cost effectiveness? Were these new technologies worth the cost?
The EPA proposed that these potential control options were not cost-effective. For instance, take the dioxin destruction system. The estimated reduction in dioxins and furans measured in toxic equivalency, or TQ, was tiny, only about 0.2 grams of toxic equivalency per year, per unit.
That sounds incredibly small.
It is. And the cost-effectiveness ratio, it was calculated at an eye-watering $1.42 million per gram of PCDF TTQ reduced.
Wow, $1.42 million to reduce 1 gram of toxic equivalent dioxin emissions. That number sounds astronomical. Why is that considered prohibitively expensive in the context of EPA regulation?
It is enormous. Look, cost-effectiveness thresholds vary across EPA programs, but when the cost per unit of pollution reduced gets into the millions like that, the agency typically decides that the marginal environmental gain just isn't worth the massive economic burden on the industry, especially if the baseline risk, remember the 9 in 1 million actual MIR, is already deemed acceptable.
So, considering the high capital and operational costs of these systems and the very small emissions reductions they'd achieve,
The EPA determined that mandating these systems just wasn't necessary to satisfy that ample margin of safety requirement under the Clean Air Act.
okay, so the EPA is essentially maintaining the current standards for the regulated pollutants. But the review also identified some critical gaps, right? Previously unregulated hazardous air pollutants, or HAPs.
Yes, specifically hydrogen cyanide, HCN, and hydrogen fluoride, HF. The Clean Air Act requires them to address all known HAP emissions from these source categories eventually.
So what is the EPA proposing to do about HCN and HF? Let's take HCN first.
For HCN, which comes primarily from solid fuel boilers, the EPA is proposing a new emission standard, 5.0 parts per million by volume, PPMV, on a dry basis. This is the new MACT standard.
Okay, but critically, how did they arrive at that number?
Well, the standard is based on emissions data derived from only one single unit within that entire subcategory, just one.
Mm.
And because of that limited data, the EPA had to use a statistical method called the upper prediction limit, UPL, to try and account for performance variability across the whole sector.
If they're only getting reliable data from one unit, did they consider mandating better control technology for HCN, something to maybe improve safety and give them more certainty in the data?
They did consider it. Specifically, they looked at requiring a caustic scrubber, which is a common and generally effective control device for acid gases like HCN.
Hmm.
But again, the EPA determined that mandating it was not warranted based on cost effectiveness. The calculated cost was approximately $163,000 per ton of HCN reduced.
Okay, help us understand why $163,000 per ton of reduced pollution isn't considered cost effective here. It sounds like a lot, but maybe not compared to the dioxin example.
It's less than the dioxin example, for sure, but the EPA weighs the marginal benefit against significant compliance costs and, importantly, environmental trade-offs.
What trade-offs?
They pointed out two major factors. First, the cost itself, while lower, was still deemed too high relative to the perceived risk from HCN at these levels. Second, the non-air quality impacts were a deciding factor. A caustic scrubber generates massive amounts of wastewater. That wastewater would then require expensive treatment and disposal, creating a new environmental problem.
Ah, so solving one problem creates another.
Exactly. And the scrubber also requires additional energy to operate. So the EPA concluded that the MACT floor standard of 5.0 ppmv was sufficient to protect public health without generating these new complex environmental management issues like increased wastewater production.
That's a perfect illustration of that regulatory balancing act weighing direct pollution reduction against secondary environmental impacts and compliance complexity. Okay, now, what about the other unregulated HAP, hydrogen fluoride, HF?
For HF, which is emitted by HWC incinerators and cement kilns, the challenge was purely data-driven. The EPA simply couldn't establish a reliable numerical emission limit.
Why not?
Because for cement kilns, a staggering 71% more than two-thirds of the collected emissions data was below the detection limits of the measurement methods. You simply can't regulate what you can't reliably measure across the industry.
So what's the workaround then, when you lack complete, consistent data like that?
Because of this lack of reliable data, the administrator proposed using a work practice standard under the Clean Air Act instead of setting a numerical emission limit. This is a common regulatory tool when emissions are difficult or impossible to measure consistently.
And what does a work practice standard mean for the facility? What do they actually have to do?
It means the affected facilities, the incinerators and cement kilns, must adopt and follow specific operating procedures, maintenance schedules, and quality assurance protocols designed to minimize HF emissions. Rather than hitting a specific number coming out of the stack, they have to prove they're following the prescribed practices.
How soon would they need to comply?
They're required to demonstrate compliance with these work practices within 3 years after the final rule is published. And the initial compliance test, showing they have the practices in place, would be due 6 months after that deadline. It forces a procedural change, a way of operating, rather than mandating a specific technology or emission rate.
And finally, there were two major administrative compliance shifts proposed within this HWC NESHAP rule that affect how states oversee these facilities. What were those?
First, the EPA is proposing to remove the blanket malfunction exemption. This is actually pretty crucial.
Why is that significant?
Because it means the emission standards must apply continuously, even during periods of startup and shutdown. Historically, those periods were often exempted, allowing for higher emissions. This move aligns the rule with a key DC Circuit Court decision that required standards to apply at all times.
Okay, constant compliance. And the second major shift involves Title V permits.
Yes. The EPA is proposing to allow states to exempt HWC area sources, which are generally smaller facilities, from needing Title V operating permits.
Now, why that change? Title V permits are usually seen as a key tool for compliance tracking and public oversight. Is the EPA trying to loosen oversight here?
The EPA is arguing that Title V permits are unnecessarily burdensome, specifically for these HWC area sources. Their rationale is that these facilities are already required to comply with the comprehensive permitting requirements under a different law, Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA. RCRA permits, regardless of the source size, and are quite detailed for hazardous waste facilities.
So the argument is regulatory overlap.
Essentially, yes. Since most HWC area sources already have a good compliance history and already hold these detailed RCRA permits, the EPA believes that state-issued non-Title V operating permits, which would still incorporate the NESHAP requirements, can achieve high compliance without the massive additional administrative cost and paperwork burden associated with the Title V program. It's framed as an efficiency move aimed at reducing regulatory duplication for smaller players.
That's an incredibly exhaustive look into the dense regulatory world of the EPA. Let's shift our focus now immediately to the crisis that is affecting millions of travelers and will definitely impact the upcoming holiday season, the direct fallout of the shutdown on air travel, infrastructure, and public safety.
Yeah, the fallout from that 41-day shutdown, particularly the loss of critical staff, hit the National Airspace System, the AMNS, hard and fast.
The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, issued an emergency order effective November 7th. That was 3 days before the final Senate vote to even end the crisis. That really shows the urgency and the depth of the safety concern they had.
This order mandated severe, immediate operational limitations on all air carriers, no exceptions. Carriers were required to reduce their total daily scheduled domestic operations by a mandatory 10% between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. local time.
Wow.
And this was a direct, unavoidable consequence of severe air traffic controller staffing constraints caused by that prolonged lapse in appropriations. They just didn't have enough people.
That 10% cut is massive. We're talking potentially thousands of flights removed from the schedule during peak travel hours. That's going to have a cascade effect across the entire network, isn't it? Especially heading right into the Thanksgiving travel rush.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy had been issuing increasingly dire warnings for weeks. He stated that if the shutdown continued, air travel would be, quote, reduced to a trickle before Thanksgiving. And the reason is the human capital drain, the controllers.
Just how bad was the drain? Do we have numbers on that?
The data is alarming. During the 41-day shutdown, controller retirement surged. Normally, you see maybe 4 per day retire. During the shutdown, it jumped to between 50 and 20 per day.
Wait, the retirement rate quadrupled or quintupled during the shutdown? What are the implications of losing that many highly specialized, experienced controllers that quickly? It must take years to train them.
The implications are serious and long-lasting. Air traffic control isn't a job you can fill overnight. It requires years of rigorous training, on-the-job experience. When 15 to 20 experienced controllers walk out the door daily, the system loses irreplaceable institutional knowledge and operational capacity almost immediately.
So the staffing drain created an immediate, unavoidable safety risk that basically forced the FAA's hand.
Exactly. The 10% reduction was calculated based on the overall loss of operational capacity. Though the rule did stipulate that no single airline could be cut by more than 15% to try and ensure some equity across the major carriers.
This whole crisis just proves, doesn't it, that even when the government technically reopens, its operational efficiency can be severely damaged for months, maybe longer.
And the visible strain on the system was almost immediate. On Monday afternoon, there was that mobile lounge collision at Washington Dulles Airport, IAD. A piece of airport transport equipment struck a dock, sending 18 people to the hospital, thankfully, with non-life-threatening injuries.
Now, we can't directly link the FAA order to that specific accident, obviously.
No, of course not.
But it does underscore the kind of systemic disruption and the real-world operational risks facing airport infrastructure and personnel right now. Things get stressed.
That event highlights that systemic disruption affects every single layer of the travel experience. The FAA emergency order isn't just about maybe having longer flight delays in Newark or Orlando. It's about the overall structural resilience of the National Airspace System. The system won't just instantly spring back to full capacity simply because the shutdown ended.
That staffing hole is real.
It's real. And that 10% reduction will likely remain in effect for some time, deeply impacting holiday travel and, frankly, the airline industry's bottom line throughout this period.
Okay, switching gears now to energy and resource development. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, BOM, seems to be actively pushing forward with leasing expansions, driven by recent legislation and executive orders.
Yes, exactly. BOM announced the proposed notice of sale for the Cook Inlet OCS Oil and Gas Lease Sale 1. This is happening now because it's explicitly mandated by that recent law, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, OBBA.
Okay.
The bid opening for this sale is scheduled way out for March 4, 2026, but the announcement pushes resource development forward in Alaska's Outer Continental Shelf, regardless of all the recent political drama in D.C.
And BioM is also simultaneously initiating steps toward critical mineral development, but this time offshore the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, CNMI. This sounds tied to that larger strategic goal of reducing foreign mineral reliance.
It is entirely strategic. This stems directly from a new policy direction driven by executive orders, including one titled Unleashing America's Offshore Critical Minerals and Resources.
So, what's the specific action BOMM is taking for CNMI?
BOMM is publishing what's called a Request for Information and Interest, RFI. They're basically putting out feelers to identify potential leasing areas for outer continental shelf minerals offshore the CNMI. This RFI is the very initial step toward potential commercial leasing down the road. It's a crucial part of the administration's broader push to secure a domestic supply chain for critical minerals, things used in everything from electric vehicle batteries to advanced defense technology.
Interesting. Now, while energy resources seem to be moving forward, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, is actually granting extensions on some new construction standards, effectively slowing down certain new requirements.
Correct. HUD announced an additional delay on compliance deadlines for certain energy efficiency standards for new construction. Those deadlines are now pushed back until May 28, 2026.
And which programs does this cover?
This extension covers several key programs: FHA-insured housing, the Public Housing Capital Fund, and Section 8 project-based voucher programs.
Why the delay? Is it regulatory pushback from industry or stakeholders?
It seems like it. The delay is explicitly in place, while HUD, along with the USDA, which shares some authority here, review the underlying cost-benefit analysis of the standards. They're also gathering additional public comment.
So that suggests some stakeholders raised concerns about the economic feasibility, maybe, or the effectiveness of the proposed energy efficiency standards.
That's the strong implication. It led the agencies to essentially pump the brakes and reevaluate the data and the potential impacts before forcing compliance.
Okay. And finally, let's touch on a very specific, almost hyper-local regulatory action in fisheries management. This one from the National Marine Fisheries Service, NMFS.
Yes. Effective at 1 minute past midnight, 1001 hours, on November 10th, 2025, NMFS closed the Blue Line tilefish commercial fishery for the entire rest of the year.
Wow, just shut it down completely.
Completely. This closure runs through December 31st. And it wasn't a discretionary decision. It was necessary because the regional administrator determined, based on real-time harvest data flowing in, that 100% of the 2025 total allowable landings, the TAL, the quota had already been caught.
So the fishermen hit the limit and the system automatically triggered the closure.
Exactly. This action is mandated by the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. It's a rapid, mandatory closure based purely on hitting a preset numerical limit.
It's really a perfect example of that non-political machinery of government operating precisely as designed, isn't it? Regardless of all the drama happening on Capitol Hill.
Absolutely. It's the meticulous management of a natural resource continuing until the regulatory limit is reached, and then bang, the system shuts down that activity instantly, as planned.
Okay, let's shift our final focus now to a deep dive into health, safety, and federal benefits. We can start with the implications of open season for federal employees that time when they choose their health and benefits plans, and what the data is telling us about the federal workforce itself right now.
Right. The open season period always gives us a crucial snapshot of the health and wellness concerns facing the federal workforce. And there was a recent study by MetLife that had a pretty striking finding.
What was that?
It found that only 35% of federal employees report feeling holistically healthy.
Only 35%? That sounds low. How does that compare nationally?
It is low. It's lower than the national average for all U.S. employees, which stands at 39%. So federal workers are reporting lower overall wellness than their private sector counterparts.
But wasn't there a disparity within the federal workforce itself?
Yes, and that's what's truly illuminating. Only 27%, barely more than a quarter of federal managers, reported feeling holistically healthy. Compare that to 40% of non-managers.
Wow, that's a huge gap. Why would federal managers feel significantly less healthy than the employees they supervise? What does that suggest?
Well, it strongly suggests that the high-stress environment, the increased political scrutiny they often face, the burden of managing through crises like the recent shutdown, and the pressure to implement complex new policies like those EPA regulations we just spent time unpacking are disproportionately affecting that management layer.
So burnout is hitting managers harder.
It seems likely they're experiencing far greater stress, burnout, and wellness gaps than the rest of the workforce. And that should be a major concern for federal agencies trying to maintain leadership continuity and operational efficiency. You need healthy managers.
Meanwhile, the benefits market, naturally, is adapting to target federal retirees, particularly those transitioning into Medicare. What are we seeing there?
Absolutely. The carriers are definitely trying to sweeten the deal for retirees. Kaiser Permanente, for example, is offering some specific high-value financial benefits if you combine their Medicare Advantage plan with your federal employee health benefits, FEHB coverage.
What kind of benefits?
For retirees enrolled in their high and standard option FEHB plans, they can receive up to $2,400 per year. That's $200 a month reimbursed for their Medicare Part B premiums. That's a significant chunk of change.
That could make a big difference for retirees on fixed incomes.
Definitely. And furthermore, their Prosper members also benefit from lower copays for primary and specialty care visits, and importantly, no annual deductible. These are tangible financial incentives designed to make retirement health care significantly more affordable for feds.
We also saw a couple of brief notices published about TRICARE and the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, RWIP. Anything major there?
Mostly administrative updates. The out-of-pocket expenses for calendar year 2026 for TRICARE Prime and select retiree beneficiaries, specifically Group A and B retirees, those were officially published.
Damn.
Standard procedure.
And the Ryan White program.
Regarding RWAP, the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, published a discussion on the methodology they use for determining eligibility for Part A and B grants. They confirmed the core methodology itself remains unchanged.
So why the notice then?
They're providing public notice because new distribution factors, basically how they decide to spread the funds geographically based on updated data, are being used. And those new factors require transparency before they're implemented in the grant awards. So no policy change, just updated data inputs needing public notification.
Okay, now let's return to the EPA one last time for a highly technical but actually globally significant proposed rule regarding chemical use. This one under the Significant New Alternatives Policy Program, or SNAP.
Yes, and this is where we see the EPA propose to fundamentally overhaul how they regulate certain refrigerants and fire suppression agents. It involves a major shift in compliance focus in a, frankly, deregulatory direction in some ways.
How so? What's the core change regarding flammable refrigerants used in things like residential and commercial heating and cooling systems?
The EPA is proposing to move away from its past practice of prescribing specific, rigid refrigerant charge size limits for common refrigerants like R290, propane, R441A, and the mildly flammable HFC-32. Historically, the EPA maintained a very detailed list of exactly how much of these refrigerants could be used in different types of equipment.
So they're getting out of the business of setting those specific limits?
Instead of continually updating those rigid federal limits, the EPA is proposing to rely on updated industry consensus safety standards.
Which specific safety standard are they pointing to as the new benchmark?
They're pointing to the fourth edition of UL standard 60335240. It's a key industry safety standard for appliances. And importantly, they're relying on certification by OSHA-recognized, nationally recognized testing laboratories. NRTLs think labs like UL itself, Intertech CSA Group.
So instead of the EPA being the direct rule setter on charge limits, they're essentially deferring to the industry safety standard and the third-party certification process. Why is this such a major shift in regulatory strategy?
It's a huge shift, because that fourth edition of the UL standard is crucial here. That updated standard incorporates new safety mitigations, things like mandatory leak detection systems and safety shutoff valves, which effectively reduce the risk associated with flammability, even if you have larger total charge sizes in the equipment.
So the technology has advanced to make larger charges safer.
Exactly. By relying on NRTL certification, which confirms that a specific product meets that updated UL standard, the EPA increases flexibility for the industry. Manufacturers can innovate, maybe use larger, more efficient charge sizes, as long as they build in the required safety technology confirmed by the NRTL.
And the EPA framed this as deregulatory.
Yes. The EPA explicitly noted this is a deregulatory action under a recent executive order aimed at reducing prescriptive burdens. It allows the technology and the standards to evolve without needing constant, slow updates to the federal regulations themselves.
That makes sense. It allows technology to advance potentially faster than the federal rulemaking process. Okay, beyond residential units, the SNAP program is also focusing on refrigerants used in motor vehicle air conditioning, MVAC systems. Mm-hmm. What's happening there?
Yes, the rule proposes listing HFO-12348E, that's a newer, lower global warming potential refrigerant, as acceptable for use in new heavy-duty on-highway vehicles and buses. And crucially, also allowing it as a retrofit option for existing light and medium-duty vehicle, MVACs.
retrofitting older cars with newer refrigerants.
Yes. Furthermore, specific refrigerant blends like R443A, R4366, and R480A are proposed as acceptable for retrofitting light and medium-duty pickup trucks and vans specifically.
Now, you have different refrigerants, some flammable, some less so. To manage the distinct safety and chemical profiles, what specific mandate is the EPA proposing to prevent dangerous mix-ups during servicing?
That's a critical safety point. To prevent improper mixing or charging, which can be extremely dangerous if you put the wrong refrigerant in a system not designed for it, they're requiring unique service fittings for R444A, R456A, and R480A when used in these MVAC retrofits.
Unique fittings.
Yes, along with new specifications for the high side and low side service ports on the vehicle, and even for the 30-pound cylinders the refrigerants come in. These unique physical connections must be added to the regulations to ensure that only the correct specified refrigerant can actually be added to the systems designed for them. It's a physical safeguard.
Okay, good. And finally, let's talk quickly about fire suppression systems. What new agent is the EPA accepting for use in certain situations?
The EPA is proposing the acceptance of a specific blend known as 2-BTPCO2 as a total flooding fire suppression agent.
And where would this be used?
This is primarily intended for specific, normally unoccupied applications. Think things like aircraft engine nacelles or the auxiliary power units, APUs on planes. The key feature here is that the blend itself is non-flammable.
But what about the environmental concerns? Isn't the main component, 2-BTP, classified as a volatile organic compound, VOC, which contributes to smog?
It is a VOC, yes. Mm. The EPA assessed the potential environmental release very carefully. They estimate that only about 1 metric ton of 2-BTP would actually be released into the atmosphere annually from this proposed end use across the entire country.
1 metric ton nationally? That sounds incredibly small.
It is statistically tiny. They calculated it would be about 7.5 × 10⁸%. That's 0.00000075% of total U.S. VOC emissions. And because some of those releases would occur at high cruising altitudes where the environmental impact, particularly ground-level ozone formation, is considered less severe, the EPA determined that the environmental impact from this specific VOC use is not a significant concern. The fire safety benefit outweighs the negligible VOC contribution.
That's a really deep dive into the technical details governing the chemicals that touch our daily lives and our climate. Okay, to wrap up our administrative deep dive, we have one more critical and potentially sensitive action. This one from the Social Security Administration, the SSA.
Yes. On November 10th, the SSA published modifications to a major system of records notice, or SORN. This one covers the master files of SSN holders and SSN applications. It's foundational data.
And while much of the published change just clarifies internal system maintenance details for the SSA,
two entirely new routine uses were added to the notice, and that's the significant part.
Okay, what do these new routine uses permit? What's the change?
They permit the sharing of SSN holder information linked to your Social Security number with certain outside entities.
And these new routine uses, which fundamentally expand the ability of the SSA to share SSN data externally, they become effective when?
They will become effective pretty soon, on December 12, 2025.
Okay, this sounds like it could be a major privacy concern and really needs some elaboration. What kind of outside entities are we talking about here? Is this for academic researchers doing studies, state governments verifying benefits, or are we talking about private contractors doing work for SSA? What are the guardrails on this new routine use, and how significant a privacy shift is this for you, the listener?
That is the essential question. And the SORN itself remains somewhat broad on specifics, but the potential impact is significant. The term outside entities in these federal system of records notices can often encompass a wide range of state agencies, yes, other federal agencies, potentially federal contractors performing specific functions, or even external researchers conducting analysis that the SSA deems necessary for its operations or for broader policy evaluation.
So the fundamental shift is?
The fundamental shift is that data previously protected strictly within the SSA's internal framework is now potentially open to sharing under specific conditions defined by these new routine uses.
Yep.
For the average person, this means that data associated with their Social Security number, information previously held very closely by the SSA, could now potentially be utilized by certain external organizations starting next month. It underscores the need for careful monitoring by privacy advocates and Congress to ensure proper usage guardrails and adequate privacy protection measures are strictly enforced as this goes live.
That definitely brings us to the end of this incredibly dense update. When you synthesize everything we've just discussed over the last half hour or so, what stands out most to you about the scope of just this two-day period?
It's the sheer complexity and breadth, isn't it? I mean, in just 48 hours, the federal government simultaneously navigated a critical, highly controversial foreign policy shift with that Syrian leader's visit.
Right.
It conducted incredibly high-stakes political maneuvering to finally halt a $90 billion financial and economic crisis with the shutdown ending.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very same time, finalized or proposed dozens of hyper-specific, deeply complex regulatory changes. I mean, these rules govern everything from the air quality near hazardous waste incinerators to the cost of your health insurance, the safety protocols for air travel, and even how your fundamental data, your social security number, can potentially be shared.
It just demonstrates that the actual work of the federal government is never just one thing, is it? It is thousands of critical threads running simultaneously, even when the political structure is supposedly shut down or in crisis.
Exactly. The machine keeps grinding, regardless of the headlines sometimes.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, beyond the headlines and the basic promise that the government is technically open again?
I think it means that while the shutdown is technically over, the damage to essential federal services is proving to be enduring and pervasive. The most immediate direct impact on your life right now and probably for the foreseeable future stems from that air travel crisis we discussed.
Because despite the political deal.
Right. Despite the deal, the FAA emergency order is still in effect, requiring air carriers to cut 10% of their operations purely for safety concerns. And that surge in air traffic controller retirements, losing 15 to 20 highly trained specialists per day during the crisis, that underscores that the government's capacity to operate efficiently was severely degraded.
And that damage requires systemic restrictions.
Yes. Meaning flight delays and cancellations are highly likely to deeply affect holiday travel and probably travel well beyond that. The government is technically open, yes, but its operating efficiency is impaired. And that impairment is now manifesting directly in your travel plans.
That's such a crucial point. The consequence often outlasts the crisis itself.
Almost always. The recovery takes time.
Okay, and let's end today with a final provocative thought for you to mull over. President Trump signaled support for the shutdown deal, right? But he also proposed paying out that $2,000 tariff rebate check using revenue that his own administration lawyers are simultaneously arguing to the Supreme Court is merely incidental to the actual trade action.
The legal contradiction we discussed earlier.
Exactly. So here's the thought. If the Supreme Court rules against him, ending his authority to collect those billions of dollars in tariffs, how quickly could that massive populist economic promise, those $2,000 checks, simply evaporate? And maybe more importantly, what happens then to the billions already collected and potentially earmarked for that dividend? It really highlights the precarious, legally contradictory foundation of a key economic pillar of this administration, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Food for thought, indeed, especially as we head into what's likely to be a very eventful election year.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the federal news update.
We'll catch you next time.